The following episode contains language that may not be suitable for young listeners, as these interviews were too much fun, so listener discretion advised.
Hi, this is Maria Olson. You may know me from Trophy Heads or Starry Eyes and maybe Paranormal Activity 3, and I want to welcome you to Anthony T's Horror Show, because it's an awesome show.
Hi, my name is Jessica Cameron, and you're listening to Anthony T's Horror Show.
Hey, fellow horror fans. This is Troy Escamilla, the director of Party Night and Mrs. Claus, and you are listening to Anthony T's Horror Show. Enjoy.
Welcome to another edition of Anthony T's Horror Show. I'm Anthony T. This is it. This is the Rockin' Shock Show. There's a reason why I haven't put out a new podcast in about a couple weeks, as I've been busy working on this show. And when I was doing all the editing and looking at all the interviews, I realized I have way too much material. Because this is a 60-minute show, everyone. Sometimes we'll go over to 70 minutes, but I try to keep it around 60, 70 minutes. I had at least about 90 minutes worth of interviews. So I had to face a dilemma. Do I air the whole show all at once? Considering the fact that I'm probably going to get more listeners for this show than for most of my episodes. So I don't want to have an episode where it goes 90 minutes, you like the show so much, then you find the next episode, it's only about 60 minutes. That's because 60 minutes is usually the running time here on the podcast. I may go over 10 minutes, but I usually try to keep it around 60, 70 minutes. This episode, with all the interviews, was like 90 minutes, at least. Then you gotta add all the commercials. I have to give my thoughts on the convention, and I have to give a film recommendation as well. So, by the time the episode gets done, I'd be over 100 minutes. And that's not the length of Anthony T's Horror Show, because I'm one of those people that does not like to sit through two-hour podcasts. I'm one of those people that likes to sit through maybe an hour and a half, usually, because I have other things to do. So, plus the fact that some of these interviews that I had at Rockin' Shock are some of the craziest interviews that I had all weekend. With bad language, me saying Shakespeare shitstorm a couple times. Not my fault, it's Lloyd Kaufman's new film that's coming out next year. So, I had to make a choice. Do I air it all at once, knowing that I would have to put a disclaimer at the beginning and turn off some people from listening to the show? Or do I divide it into two shows, have the main actors on one show where it's family friendly and there's no problems? And I chose to go that route because it's better for the Rock and Shock show if it's divided into two parts. So, in the next episode, I will have interviews with John Dugan, Spencer Charnez of Ice Nine Kills, and Bill Johnson. This episode is pretty much an episode where it's pretty much not safe for work. Meaning, there is bad language in this episode. So, I'm again warning you, this episode contains bad language. Meaning, listener discretion advise, as some of these interviews was just a very fun time. Like the opening interview that I have coming up on the other side. because it was just fun. Love hanging out with those guys. Probably one of my favorite interviews out of the whole weekend. Seriously. In this episode, you'll also hear interviews from Ben Goldsmith, writer of The Seance Room, and Jason Levy and Stephen Della Sala from Terrifier, as they were there to promote their latest film, Abnormal Attractions. So I'll go down what's on the list of interviews when I come back. But remember, I'm also doing a charity drive this month for Scares That Cares. If you go to Anthony T's Horror Show on Facebook, somewhere I'll have the link for the fundraising drive. If you can't find it on the Facebook page, go to Anthony T's Horror on Twitter. That's definitely pinned on the top of the official Twitter page for Anthony T's Horror Show. So please donate whatever you can to Scares That Care. This is definitely a great organization, and this is definitely something I truly support and all horror fans should support. With that, here's the commercial for Scares That Care. Every day, there's a family struggling with hospital bills to care for their sick child who is fighting an illness. There's a woman who is fighting breast cancer and is having trouble making ends meet while paying for their treatment. And there are burn victims that are going through treatments to heal their deep wounds. There is a charity in the horror community that helps these people. Scares That Care is an organization that helps families deal with the bills for their child. They help women get the treatment they need to fight breast cancer, and they help people who are dealing with severe burns get the help they need to heal. Scares That Care is a 100% volunteer organization and 501c3 nonprofit charity that is dedicated to helping these people in fighting real monsters. To find out more information or to donate to Scares That Care, you can go to www.scaresthatcare.org. Every donation helps Scares That Care fight real monsters. Besides Anthony T's Horror Show, you can also listen to these other fine podcasts on the Doc Discussions Network. Doc Discussions, hosted by Philip Perrone and Michael Darwin. You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, a Game of Thrones podcast. Bullets, Brothels, and Bots, a Westworld podcast. Halloween Boutique, Psychotronic Reviews, and Searching for American Gods. You can find Doc Discussions on the web at www.docdiscussions.com. And Doc Discussions is also available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify.
Hey guys, this is Steven Christina. I am the founder, owner, creator, and host of Super Retro Throwback Reviews. Are you looking for the best movie reviews, music reviews, video game reviews, and Comic-Con coverage all around? Well then, look no further. Definitely check out Super Retro Throwback Reviews on YouTube and our new audio podcast, the new and improved Super Retro Throwback Reviews Audio Files version 2.0 on the following media distributors: Podbean, Google Play, Stitcher, SoundCloud, iTunes, and Spotify.
Class is over, John. Time for something new and improved.
Welcome back. Now, I had a very fun time at Rock and Shock this past year. And as you see in about the first three interviews, you can see I'm having a really fun time as I really enjoyed myself. I'll get more into this next episode because I want to save my thoughts for the second part. But you got some good interviews here. More on the independent film side. First up will be James Lamont and Erica Looker from It Came From the 508 Productions, as they talk about their film One Last Kill, The Ties That Bind Part 1. After that, I talk with Troma's Ron Mackey about convention life and working with Lloyd Kaufman. Then afterwards, I'll be talking to comic book writer Ben Goldsmith from the Seance Room. Definitely check out his book series. And finally, I will be talking to Steven Della Sala and Jason Levy from Fuzz on the Lens Productions. They were a part of the indie sensation Terrifier. I talk with them about that. Their latest film, Abnormal Attraction, which they were there to promote. And a documentary that might interest you horror fans. I'll give you a hint. Think about a film that came out recently that was remade. But without further ado, here's my interview with James Lamont and Erica Looker to kick things off on my Rock and Shock coverage. And I'll be back at the end for a film recommendation. I'm here with James Lamont from It Came From the 508 Productions. How are you doing today, James?
Hey, how's it going, Anthony? I'm doing pretty good. Doing pretty good.
Very good. Now, tell me, how did you get into filmmaking?
Basically, it was, I've been writing scripts since I was like 8 or 9 years old, give or take. I was like 4th grade. I wrote my first stage play. So I've always had a passion for writing it, but it was actually a dare that got me to direct my first movie. Because I was in an argument. I've been a film nerd my whole life. I was in an argument with a friend at a party, and he was like, "Oh, if you think you could do so much better making a horror movie, why don't you do it?" Because we were, you know, shitting around. And I said, "You know what? I will." And then we set out and we made One Last Kill.
And what are some of your influences in filmmaking?
In filmmaking, as a director, I try to suck in as much as possible. So everybody from Martin Scorsese, John Carpenter. I'm a big John Carpenter fan. I always love what John Carpenter is doing. Writing side, King, Kuntz. I'm a big fan of Stephen King. But I try to kind of block that out when I'm creating something, because I want to keep it a little more just, I want to do what I'm doing. You know what I'm saying? But probably King and Carpenter, I would say, are my biggest influences.
Now, you're currently filming a short film series called The Ties That Bind. What made you want to put both One Last Kill in the box in the Ties That Bind series?
Well, what came about that was my first script when we started working on all of this was actually for a feature film. And what I ended up discovering was that we were not going to be able to make that feature film with the budget that we had. So what I ended up doing was kind of breaking up these pieces of it. And when somebody, with One Last Kill, somebody this guy Johnny Surrett, who wrote the story for One Last Kill, we kind of kicked around the idea of making it into a movie. And I said, well, why don't I tie it into this other thing I'm working on, right? And he was like, oh, yeah, it sounds great. And we kind of, like, hashed it all out. And then I wrote the screenplay for One Last Kill. And we kind of just built off of that. I was like, if I can't do the whole movie in one shot, I'll break it apart and do it in little stories. So that's why we do it that way, you know?
Tell everyone about One Last Kill.
Well, I mean, basically, it's about a serial killer named Carl Stefano. He's at the end of his rope, the end of his road. He's about to, you know, he's got the cops after him, the FBI, everybody else. He's also followed by the personification of his dark impulses. And he eventually meets his match. And I don't want to spoil it from there.
No, we don't want any spoilers here.
No spoilers. So let's just say he meets his match. That's the best way to word it.
Yes, we want everyone to support independent filmmaking here.
Yes.
What was casting like for One Last Kill?
I mean, for the most part, it was actually, you know, it was pretty painless as far as casting goes. I pretty much got everybody I was looking for on the first or second try. Dan, who plays the dark side of Carl, I mean, he just sent me a 15-minute video and he just knocked it out of the park. So I was like, you're in. There wasn't even any question about that. Steven, who played Carl Stefano, he was actually my second choice, but he still did a very good job right off the bat. There wasn't really any kind of difficulty. And when it came to casting Piper, Erica was my first choice for Piper, so it was really easy.
How you doing, Erica?
Good, how are you? I remember you.
How's it going today?
It's going amazing. You know, just walking around, like, seeing people, chit-chatting, grabbing some things, you know.
Now, what was it like playing your character in the film One Last Kill?
So, playing Piper was... it was actually really fun for me because, I mean, when you know, you're a female in a horror movie, you have to... You're kind of going by the old tropes of, like, being scared and, like, jumping at every, you know, noise and stuff. But, like, with Piper, it was like... She knew what she was doing. She wasn't messing around. Like, she was a woman with a plan. So it was almost like... I kind of related to that a little bit. You know, like, when she was scared, but, like, she knew what she was doing at the end of it.
What was it like writing the screenplay for this film?
So, I mean, James and I had a lot of fun with that because we, you know, we looked at what we had on paper and we're like, what can we do to make this more real life? You know, like, we took it and we're like, let's think of if you were talking to it, like, when you get it on paper, it's one thing, but then when you're reading it, it's like, you want to, you know, have that real type of conversation. So, it was really fun to kind of read it out and figure it out as a real conversation, but also like, yeah, this is kind of like two people plotting against each other in the same way, so it was like two opposite ends of the spectrum coming together for a same common goal, but I don't know, it was really fun. I liked it.
For me, yeah, I mean, like, when Eric and I collaborated on the final screenplay, it was a hoot. I mean, there's a lot of me in there, there's a lot of her in there, and, you know, when you're co-writing with somebody, you bounce, the repertoire can be a lot more interesting than your solo writing something. Like, I wrote The Box by myself, and it came out to be a very different mood than One Last Kill, but I think that also fits with what we had going on with One Last Kill, because you had a guy and a girl in conflict, so we definitely were able to get to something a little more real with that, because we had a female perspective and a male perspective in the screenwriting, and I think that's what makes that movie really special.
What made you want to focus on the psychological aspects of the main character in One Last Kill?
Well, what really, I mean, to me, you never see a serial killer movie, right, in that form, at least not since Henry, really, in that form where you're looking at that kind of raw perspective on a serial killer. And when you take that and you put it in, you're like, you're putting it in his shoes, you're in Carl's shoes for most of the movie, he's in the driver's seat, and you give him that visual diversity when you have the other character playing his dark urges. I just saw a lot of potential there to really get to something incredibly dark about, because you have this evil inside you. I think everybody does. Everybody has the capacity to do it. It's just a matter of what's going to push you. So I felt like if we can get to the core of what's pushing Carl and visualize it as a person, we can take it to all sorts of new depths of darkness. And that's, I mean, that's what we were really going for.
Erica?
So, I mean, the way I thought it was shot was really cool, because it was like, you're taking it from one character's perspective, and the way I see it is the film is like from a male killer's perspective, and then the female antagonist comes in with almost the same type of MO, and it really fucks them up. So to see it done that type of way was, I don't know, it was really cool for me, because I feel like you don't see that enough in horror where, like, where women get to be, like, the bad guy. It's like, you know, we're always the people running through the woods and screaming and crying at the end, but then, you know, when you watch One Last Kill, it's like, not like that at all. And for me, that's what does it for me, because there's not enough of that in the horror industry. It's a boys' club, and, you know, you need the women's perspective. It's like, you know, women be crazy. let us get crazy sometimes, you know? Like, it's a very understated type of thing, and you don't really see it. It's very underhanded, and I think that's what's really cool about it.
What was the toughest part about writing the screenplay?
Editing what we had, really. It was mostly, you know, getting a dialogue that felt natural between two people who had a very... who had the same MO but wanted to appear normal. So, you know, two crazy people trying to talk to each other, trying to seem like we're not crazy. So it wasn't that it was difficult, it was just, it was kind of fun that way, trying to be like, how do you disguise it, but also have it, you know, for a third party see that, like, oh, what the fuck is going on? That's what I like to know.
Okay, so riffing off of what Erica said, I think that really the toughest part was not only having these two real people having this dialogue where they're trying to pretend to be normal when they're both quite bonkers, you throw in that third monkey wrench with the dark character, this creature that's talking to Carl, and you try to work that dialogue to make that flow. That was a real challenge. It was also a challenge to shoot, too. So, like, it wasn't just like it was like we wrote the script and like, we had to play with it while we were on set, too. Like, we had to really experiment with a lot of things. But I think the end result really speaks for itself. Like, it was challenging, but it was rewarding as hell, because I thought that came out great.
Now, most of this film takes place in the woods. What made you want to shoot in the woods?
Well, I mean, it's the classic fairy tale, right? You know? Hansel and Gretel following the breadcrumb trail, or, you know, Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It's the woods just represents something terrifying to human nature, really, you know? And I just think that that is, like, the perfect backdrop for any kind of horror movie, really. And, I mean, secondly, it's cheap.
True. Do you have another film coming out, which I also see you have over here at Rockin' Shock, called The Box?
Yes, sir.
Tell everyone about this film.
This film actually is a part two in The Ties That Bind. It's a loose sequel, sidequel to One Last Kill. It happens in conjunction, but not necessarily. You don't need to see One Last Kill to get The Box. It's not a sequel.
Indirect continuation.
Indirect continuation. Perfect. This movie's very different than One Last Kill. It's not about a serial killer. It's very supernatural, very freaky. There's monsters. I really wanted to make a monster movie. That's what this movie really is. I really wanted to make a monster movie. And it's about a family, this strange husband and wife. Their daughter disappeared 2 years ago, and they're trying to reconcile their differences. They're digging out like a foundation for a greenhouse in their backyard, and they come across this massive coffin, crate, box thing. And they dig that up, they bring it into their house, trying to figure out what it is, and, well, I don't want to spoil anything, so all hell breaks loose after that. Yeah, it gets, we really pushed the boundary past what we were doing with One Last Kill on.
Now, was this an easy shoot or a difficult shoot compared to One Last Kill?
Oh, way difficult. Way more difficult. There were a lot of more factors fighting against us. We were on a shorter schedule. We were on a tighter location. We were actually in a house for the whole thing. It posed all sorts of new problems with special effects, lighting. It was a much tougher shoot, but at the same time, I think at the end, we made a much more terrifying product because of that.
This film will be world premiering at the Dead of Autumn Film Festival, which you are co-hosting. Tell me, how did this film festival happen?
Well, basically, I wanted to make a film festival. This is really what it came down to. No, I wanted to do something unique. I wanted to really bring a different kind of vibe to film festivals, because I feel like a lot of film festivals kind of get lost in the shuffle, right? And not a lot of people pay attention to everyone. So I wanted to bring something that was new. So this is actually happening at Platinum City Gaming in Taunton. It's an arcade bar, right? With a huge projector screen in it. And we're going to have all kinds of crazy stuff going on. It's not your typical... It is absolutely not your typical film festival, and that's why I wanted to do it. I was waiting until we could do something that I found was going to be really unique and awesome, you know?
Now, besides The Box, what other films will be screening at your film festival?
Oh, man, we got a huge list going on. There will be The Last Call by Into the Labyrinth. They're out of New York City. Astoria, New York, as a matter of fact. Our other film, Strawberry Lane, will be world premiering that night. It's by Jeremy Joseph Aruda. It's incredible. Beletamine by Stained Glass and Bloodbath Productions. Insomniac by Boombastic Films. The Medicus by Rob Lee Visuals. The Misplaced by Lockbridge Productions. There's a ton of stuff going on, man. It's going to be an awesome night. An awesome night. Full of awesome horror movies. It's just going to be rad.
Now, you also co-produced Strawberry Lane. Tell everyone about that film.
Okay, so Strawberry Lane is not for the faint of heart. This film is for the guys that are into stuff like a Serbian film or Eraserhead or old John Waters stuff. Like, there's like a real like artful kind of filth feel to it, you know? And that's what I loved about it, because Jeremy, man, as a writer, as a director, he has just got some guts. He is awesome. And I really can't wait for people to see this. You know, I mean, I think it's going to find a smaller audience, because I don't think a lot of people are into the extreme stuff like that, but I feel like there's a very specific, special group of people that are me, like me, that are completely twisted assholes that will love it. So I think it's going to be awesome.
Now, where will this film festival be taking place at?
Oh, man. Platinum City Gaming in Taunton, Massachusetts. It's 347 Winthrop Street. It's right off Route 44. It's going to be awesome. Like I said, it's an arcade bar. It's full of awesome stuff to do on top of these awesome films that we're going to be putting out.
And what date will the festival be taking place at?
That's on November 9th, 2009. Oh, doors are at 6 p.m.?
2019, you mean.
2019. It's been a long day, Anthony. Don't play with me, son.
Now, what are some upcoming films from It Came From the 508?
We are currently auditioning the final piece of The Ties That Bind, 14 Lambs. And I'll be auditioning that pretty much up through December. And so if anybody out there is interested, give us an give us a shout at itcamefromthe508@gmail.com, and I will get you what you need to audition. But we will be working on that up until the summer, and then we will start shooting.
How can people purchase your films?
You can catch us at a con, or I may have something up my sleeve for later this winter. That'll make it a little easier for everybody to get. I can't really talk about it yet, but very soon I will have a way for people to get our movies all the time.
What are some upcoming cons that you'll be at?
As far as this year, not much. I feel like the next thing we'll be at will be Monster Mania 2020 in New Jersey.
Cherry Hill,
exactly. Yeah, I think that's our next thing. I think we're shutting down for the winter so we can make a movie.
Well, it was nice having you on my podcast, James.
As always, brother. As always. I love talking to you.
Not a problem. Have a good day, and tell Erica I send the same regards.
Yeah, I don't know where she went, but I will. I will, brother.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm here with Ron Mackey from Troma over at the Troma booth.
Yeah.
I'm here to talk about the booth and his acting in Lloyd Kaufman's films. As you may notice him very briefly, but he usually will play a character that is quite noticeable, including the Return to Nukem High Volume 2. So how are you doing today, Ron?
I'm doing great. Just having a lot of fun here at Rock and Sock.
Now, what drew you to the horror genre and traveling to all these horror cons?
I had always been a Troma fan since the late 80s, and then just saw an ad that they were looking for extras for Poltergeist. So I came out, auditioned for that, and got to do a lot of background work there, and that led to being friends with Lloyd and helping out at conventions a little bit, and from there it just sort of snowballed. Now I'm the convention manager. I cover most of the shows in the Northeast and the Midwest, and I've been in his last three films also.
I'm going to give you a very hard question. What is your favorite Troma film?
It goes back and forth, probably between The Toxic Avenger and Cannibal the Musical.
Both very good films.
They're a lot of fun, yeah.
What is it like traveling on the road from convention to convention?
It's a lot of fun. Most of our friends are on the road, so we have a great time doing it. We get to talk about Troma, so it's really fun. These little trips, and they're all related to Troma stuff.
What are some of your favorite conventions?
Well, we love Rock and Shock. This one's always fun. We've got the bands afterwards. Also, the Monster Manias, the Horror Hounds. Both of those are fantastic shows. We have a lot of fun there and a lot of friends at each one.
Now, what's the most difficult part of traveling on the road?
I think just being away from home, being away from my animals. So, but otherwise, it's a lot of fun.
You also mentioned you act in Lloyd Kaufman's films.
Yeah.
What is it like to work with Lloyd Kaufman on a daily basis compared to, like, from film set to regular office work?
It's a lot of fun. In the regular office, most of the time, he's just a really great guy. He's a lot of fun to be around. When he's on a film set, he's a lot more serious, which I really like at first. I mean, when I first noticed it on Poltergeist, when he puts the camera on his shoulder, he's a different person. He's very serious about what he's doing, which I found really nice, because most of the movies are, on your initial look, they're boobs, blood, and comedy. But he's dead serious about the underlying message that he's trying to push with his film. And he's very serious about it, and he's serious about the acting that happens in it. And once he yells cut, he's done with that, and he'll thank you. He's apologizing for yelling if he was. Nicest guy in the world, but he's very serious about his art, and I love that about him.
Now, you briefly appear in Return to Nukem High Volumes 1 and 2, or aka Return to Nukem High. Tell me about your character in the film.
Well, I am the gym teacher for Tromaville High School, because I'm such a fine specimen of physical health, apparently. So I spend the film eating hot dogs and coaching the gym class. A lot of fun.
What was it like working on both of those films with Lloyd?
Those were fun. We shot them in Niagara Falls, and they were good. We shot in an old high school, so it was great. We had an auditorium to hang out in. It was very comfortable most of the time, but it was a good shoot. Lloyd was in a great mood for most of it.
Now, you're also going to appear in Lloyd's next film, Shakespeare Shitstorm. And I'm going to say shitstorm, because at this point, this episode is going to be not safe for work.
I think so.
Tell me about the film, and what was it like filming that film?
Okay, well, that's going to be Troma's take on Shakespeare's Tempest. Lloyd's been waiting to shoot that for a long time. It's his favorite Shakespeare story. And that was, I think, my favorite shoot. From what I've seen of the rough cut, I really think it's going to be Lloyd's best film. He has a lot to say in there, and he really does. He doesn't shy away from any of the issues he wants to approach. And I think it's going to be very good and entertaining. It's a lot of fun.
When can we expect Shakespeare Shitstorm to come out?
He's moving faster on that than I've ever seen. He's expecting to be finished with all of the final edit and everything on there by the end of the year. So we should have it showing premieres early next year.
Now, are they going to do the same road tour that they did with Return to Nukem High and Return to Nukem High Volume 2?
I believe so. We're already trying to look for places to premiere it and get things set up for next year.
Will there be a VOD option for this film?
I don't really get to that end of it myself, but I would imagine so. We usually do.
Because I also noticed you did with Return to Nukem High Volume 2 as well.
Right. Yeah, I would imagine we'll do that again.
Now, speaking of Return to Nukem High, when can people expect that Blu-ray to come out?
That one's scheduled for November 12th. You can pre-order it on Amazon right now.
What special features will be on the Blu-ray, if you know?
The only one I know about is we've got a feature-length behind-the-scenes making of. That's what's been the holdup on there, was getting that finished. So I'm not sure what else we're going to put on there, but I know that'll be there.
Now, I also know, speaking on that point, every Tromer release seems to have every Lloyd Kaufman film, seems to have a feature-length documentary. Why is that?
I think he just likes to, he feels truthful that way. He thinks everybody should know the entire story behind it. They get to see the full picture. He thinks it's good for people and entertaining.
Now, what are some of Troma's upcoming releases?
Geez, honestly, I really don't know. I'm sorry. I haven't paid any attention to what we have.
You can promote the hat.
Yes, the hats are pretty awesome. We've got hats, and they kick ass.
Will those be on the website soon?
I think they're going to be a convention only. Exclusive.
Speaking of conventions, what upcoming conventions is Troma going to be at?
Right now, we are going to be at Twin Tiers Comic Con in a couple of weeks, and Frightmare in the Falls in Niagara Falls. Otherwise, I don't think we have a whole lot scheduled until February. Astronomicon, Lloyd will be out in Detroit.
Well, thank you, Ron, for coming on to my podcast. Keep up the good work with Troma, and have a good day.
Thank you very much, Anthony. It's always a pleasure. Take care.
You too. I'm here with Ben Goldsmith, writer of the Seance Room, as I'm here to talk about his three books in that series. How are you doing today, Ben?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
What drew you into the world of comics?
I was a big fan of Batman growing up, and then I was also a big horror movie watcher, and then from there I started reading Creepy, and I started reading a lot of other horror comics, and that's where I landed.
Now, how did the idea of the Seance Room come about?
It was nice because each issue I get to talk about whatever I want to, because you have six ghosts, and it's essentially a potpourri. If I'm pissed about people not following the things that they say and being hypocrites, I can write about that in the Seance Room. If I'm pissed about the way that people are overly cautious with rules and can't live outside of them because they're too afraid of the chaos that exists, I can write about that in the Seance Room. So it's kind of a catch-all.
I was going to save this question for later, but since we're on that subject, what made you want to focus on more political issues in your first issue of the Seance Room?
It's a good question. I guess, I don't know. it sort of fell that way. I don't think that I meant to come out the gate swinging, but it's just how it ended up working. Yeah.
Now, are all the issues like that, or are they different?
Oh, they're all very different. So, yeah, the first one deals with some politics stuff, and then the second one, this girl brings the ashes of her husband to the Seance Room to find a special urn. She plants them in a tree. The tree grows and starts to look like the husband who's passed away. So that one's more about like a what if, you know?
Now, you have a central character that ties all of this together, Enrich Weiss. How did you come up with that character?
Yeah, that's a great question. He's a mix between like a dapper crypt keeper and Harry Houdini. So if those two were together and, you know, ran between universes and sort of owned a house that was magical and he was immortal and fucked with everybody and had a really dry sense of humor, that's who Heinrich Weiss is, yeah.
Why do an anthology series instead of one continuing story?
That's a really great question. When you're starting out like I am, you want to have something that people can grab onto and say, oh, I understand how he writes or what his things are, and they can read it and they get it, and there's no pressure to read two or three. The hope is that you like one enough that you will read two and three, which has been great. So that's why, because I didn't want anyone to feel pressure when buying one that they would be committed to enjoying a story. You can enjoy number one and see if it's something for you.
What made you want to make all the stories look all vintage-like?
Excellent questions, because you're nice. It's moving from the writing to the art now. Well done, sir. Because it's Harry Houdini inspired a little bit, and there's some magical elements, we based all of the art on the vintage 1920s the Keller posters and Houdini posters, and those really beautiful posters from all the old magic shows. So that's what you're seeing, is you're seeing us do a loving homage to that 1920s Art Deco magician poster era.
Now, how many books or stories are planned in this series?
So there's four for the first arc, and the last one is going to be coming out in a month from now, it'll be mid-November, December, and then we'll do a trade, and then we'll probably do another four. So, yeah, it is ongoing in the respect that I have plenty written, and there's always things to write about, so we can do whatever we want to, you know?
Now, speaking of your latest issue, tell everyone about your latest issue.
Sure. So in the latest issue, someone who works for some sort of census or governmental body comes to the mansion to sort of impose the rules on this place. And it's evident that many people have tried before. And essentially, Harry, who acts as a conduit for myself, is distrustful of anyone who is so rule-laden that they are unable to see the forest before the trees. It's really a soliloquy, more or less, to what happens when we blindly follow rules instead of accepting the chaos of our own existence.
Now, you also have another book here called Beyond the Demon, the Sea. Tell me about that book.
Sure. So that book, that has all tattoo art. So it's a Victorian-style horror, but the entire interiors are done in the American traditional vintage tattooing. So if you look through it, it has all of this, the sailor ships, the compasses, the roses, the ropes, anchors, sharks, all that stuff that you know as tattoos, but we've made it into a story in a format that you can... It's a one-shot.
What made you decide to do that?
Because I don't have any credit to lose, so it's something weird and different, and I know everyone has tattoos, and I can do weird things now still, because I don't really have people expecting anything of me, so I decided to do something new and different, and it's done really well. We've already sold about 5,000 copies.
Are there plans to do more books like that?
Yeah, so we decided to do another three, each one being a different tattooing style. So the next one is going to be greaser tattoo art, so like pinup girls, hot rods, eight balls, that type of thing. And then after that will be Japanese traditional, and then after that will be Samoan traditional, but each one being its own story.
Besides those two books, what else do you have planned in the future?
Sure. So right now, from this company called Mad Cave, there's a book called RV9, which is it'll be in shelves, I think, at your local store next month, so throughout November. And then that's a five-issue series that's done really well for us. And the one that's coming out really soon, which I'm really excited for, is a book called Second Place, which is a bodybuilding alien mockumentary book. So that should be a real blast.
Now, where can people find copies of the Seance Room?
Literally any local comic book store. You can ask them. They're in Diamond. Or you can go and find me on Instagram, which is where everyone contacts me, at MRBENAU, Mr. Ben AU. And you can just send me a message, and I'll get in touch with you.
Well, I want to thank you, Ben, for coming on to my podcast. Thank you for taking your time, and have a good day.
Hey, thanks. It's been a long time coming. I'm glad we did this.
I'm here with Steven Del Salba and Jason Levy, both from Terrifier and Abnormal Attraction. How are you both doing today?
I'm doing all right. I'm doing all right. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, we're doing great. Happy to stop by.
How did each of you get into the film business?
Well, I actually got into the film business largely in part because of Jason and his brother Mike, who's sitting right next to you. They've been making movies since they were little kids, and I was fortunate enough to go to school with them, become friends, and really bring out my joy and my love of photography and start turning it into filmmaking.
Me and my brother used to run around with my mom's video camera when we were kids. Mm-hmm. And I remember like it was yesterday, and I knew once we started doing it, this is what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And then we went to grammar school with Steve, and then we went to high school with Steve, we went to college with Steve. So it was just a relationship that formed over the years. And this is how we formed the business of Fuzz on the Lens Productions in 2010 officially. But we've been doing it ever since those high school days and grammar school days.
Now, the biggest film that both of you's been a part of is Terrifier. How did each of you get involved with Terrifier?
So we got involved through a good friend of ours, the executive producer. His name is Phil Falcone. And they were actually shooting one of these scenes at the end of the film, and he asked us to be in it. It was that simple. I mean, he just needed a few extra people to help out. No one knew that the movie was going to be what it is now. It's when it's in its infancy, and that it was going to blow up, and we were glad. We were happy to help out. As you can see, it turned into something a lot more than anyone could have ever hoped for, and now we're fortunate enough to be producing the second one and having a much bigger role in it.
With me, it was almost the same thing. We were filming this movie of Normal Attraction at the time, and Phil came on set and really liked the way we were working and saw our work ethic and our production value, and he said, hey, I'm doing this small little movie. At the time, it was small, called Terrifier. He goes, we would love to get you guys to act in it. We're trying to fill these two parts, and we want to shoot a couple pickup shots. So we said, yeah, why not? We'll do it. And then we did it, and Terrifier took off, and now we're gearing up to produce the second one with Dark Age Cinema. So it's going to be a lot of fun.
Now, what was it like working with both Damien Leone and David Howard Thornton on the film?
It was a blast. I know Damien's a very sweet and genuine guy, and so is David. And they're very relaxed. They know what they want. He's very specific of the amount of gore that he wants in his movies, and we're trying to see if we can outdo the first one, definitely, so we'll see what happens. But I think it's going to be a lot gorier.
Yeah, dare I say, the second one might be better than the first, but the key is it stays true to the original. Damien is great. He's got a lot going on in his mind. It's hard to keep up with the craziness he has, and that's just our job to turn it into a reality with him now. So the second one is going to stay true to the original, have all that gore, still have that slasher feel, and obviously Art keeps his character. The humor of that clown is really important to me, and I think that sticks around, and then we take everything else to the next level, so it'll be a lot of fun.
Now, Steven, what made you want to become a producer as well, as you have your production company, Fuzz on the Lens Productions?
Well, producing to me is the most important part of making a film. I mean, everybody likes to be an actor, likes to be in front of the camera and be seen and, you know, have that notoriety. But to me, I'd rather be behind the scenes and be the one who takes it from start to finish. So you could find the director and the writer and the script and see it in its infancy and then stick with it until it's done and watch it go out into the world and see how it lasts. So I really like that aspect of being involved in all things hands-on and taking it from start to finish.
What was both of you's favorite moment on the set of Terrifier?
I guess my favorite moment on the set of Terrifier is seeing how, like, everything's done. But basically what Steve was saying, when you make any movie, you like this. It's like having a kid. It's like seeing it when it was born and when it was created, and then watching it grow up. And in Terrifier, watching all the effects blossom into Damien's vision was the most rewarding thing, because to see the smile on his face when it was executed right, and when you're sitting down and you're watching it in a movie theater and you see the people's reactions and it's terrifying, that's what Damien wanted, and that's what Damien got.
So for me, like I said, we got involved a little bit later on in the process, and Mike, who is not here, Mike Levy, Jason's brother, he's the other founder of Fuzz on the Lens, he happens to be the exterminator who gets his head cut off, and we shot that scene with them. So we had an extra camera come in, we shot that scene, so I was really happy to be involved with that. And that, my favorite part is specifically, is watching Damien and the joy he has splashing blood all over a set. I mean, I've never seen gallons and gallons of blood come out of somebody, and that he just kept asking for more. It was everywhere. So that was my favorite part, is watching that scene come to fruition.
Now, you're probably expecting more gallons and gallons in the sequel.
Yes.
Terrifier 2.
Yes.
We gotta get big vats of blood, because Damien wants to really push the blood in this one. So, yeah, it's going to be a lot more.
There's a few interesting ways people die in this one. We can't get too far into detail, but some of them won't involve blood, but they'll still be pretty bloody, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it seemed like on his Indiegogo campaign that he wants to go even farther.
For sure.
With the sequel. Are you surprised that Terrifier has been this successful?
I'm not surprised. I mean, it's hard to say that, because anytime something does this well and starts out this small, it's surprising. But when you really think about it, what was put together deserves this. And that's why it's not that surprising. It's what people wanted, it's what they were waiting for, and they actually got it, and it was executed right. So it makes sense.
I would say the whole thing about Terrifier is these horror films today are very reliant on jump scares and ghost apparitions and things like that. And the fans just want, from when I'm traveling all over these cons, the fans want an 80s gory slasher, because that's what the horror that we all grew up loving started off as. The Nightmare on Elm Street, the Michael Myers, the Jason Voorhees, and they're putting Art the Clown up there with those iconic slashers. So it's not really surprising, because I knew once I saw the clown first and foremost up close, that is when I knew that this could be a really big iconic slasher in the industry, and it's showing that.
Both of you are here to promote your film Abnormal Attraction, which you both wrote the screenplay for.
Correct.
Tell everyone about that film.
So Abnormal Attraction is a bit of a horror comedy. It is more of a comedy than a horror, but it is about fairy tale creatures living in the real world with humans. So instead of like all the differences we have today with like race relations or something like that, it's monsters and humans not getting along and how they go about it. So it stars Malcolm McDowell, Gilbert Gottfried, Bruce Davison, Leslie Easterbrook, Ron Jeremy even has a small cameo. Lots of familiar faces you'd recognize, and maybe some you wouldn't, like Jim Hanks, who's Tom Hanks' brother, is in it as Frankenstein, or Frank Stein, actually. So it's a lot. It's a fun movie. It's a different movie. You wouldn't see anything really like it anywhere else. So
now, what was the process in casting each of those actors?
Everybody comes together from a different way. Some people we happen to be friends with, like Tyler Mane, is in it. He was Sabretooth in X-Men. He is Michael Myers. He plays the Cyclops. We met him at a film festival in Arkansas, of all places. So some people you become friends with. Other people, it's just through connections to whoever's manager. Like Malcolm, we're good friends with his manager. He helped us out, told him it was a movie he should be a part of. So there's just different channels for everybody.
Yeah, I would go with the same thing that Steve just said. You know, this is a business, the film business. I mean, there's so many talented people that never get discovered. And the whole idea behind the film industry is about networking. It's about meeting people at, like, these cons or at different events, and talking to them and just getting to know them on a personal basis. And then that's when you start to form these relationships and you start to really, you know, meet people. And you go around and you meet these actors and actresses, and you just got to realize that they're just regular human beings just like me and you, and they want to get a job, and they want to work, and they love the art, and that's what you got to go out and offer them.
How did you guys come up with the story for that film?
So we were sitting at a film festival called New York Horror Film Festival, and we were sitting down, and we were seeing all these people dressed up, just like kind of at the convention we're at today, all these people dressed up, so we wanted to make a movie that we would like to see. And I know when I was little, I wanted to watch, I loved these movies like Halloween Town, I loved Are You Afraid of the Dark, The Goosebumps, those type of monsters and humans living in the same world, because I felt like there was a lot of room for comedy in that. So we started writing the script, and the script originally started as a short film, which was only about supposed to be 20 minutes long. But then we were like, oh, why are we going to make a short film? Let's just go out and make a feature. So we went back to the writing room and made the feature. Started writing the feature.
Yeah, so pretty much like Jason said, but specifically we saw these people in all these costumes, and we saw how attracted people are to these creatures, to like who's a zombie, who's a vampire, who's some kind of undead celebrity. You know, everyone's in all these crazy costumes, and people are attracted to them. People find them sexy, and we're like, I wonder if people, if we made a movie about how instead of an AA meeting where people are alcoholics and they're trying to get over this addiction, what about an addiction to weird things? An abnormal attraction to these creatures, and that's really where it blossomed from there.
Now, what was the toughest role to cast for that film?
The toughest role to cast? Oh man, that's a tough question. Specifically, one of the toughest ones to cast, I would say, is one of the leads, Dr. Cole, who ended up being played by Bruce Davison. It's a very important part. He's really what ties the whole film together. And Robert Englund was on our mind at first. He was actually going to play the part when it was a short, like we said. And then it turned into a feature and scheduling and things changed and it just wouldn't work out with him. So we had to find a few different channels and we ended up being introduced to Bruce. And we're very happy that worked out because he's a fantastic actor and he did a great job. So he's actually an Academy Award nominated actor. And, you know, that says all you need to hear.
Now, Stephen, I also noticed that you're a producer of the upcoming Pennywise documentary, The Story of It.
Yes.
How did you become involved with that?
We got involved through that, through something pretty simple that I guess would, for a lot of indie filmmakers and people could follow this suit. We heard about it on Indiegogo. They were running a campaign looking for funding, and we reached out to them and said we were big fans of the film and wanted to help out and be a part of it however we can. And, you know, one thing led to another, and then we're producers. We shot a lot of the interviews, and we're really excited. It's going to be coming out very soon.
So what was the question?
We're talking about
the Pennywise. Yeah, so we met, we funded it on, it was on Indiegogo, and we met our good friend John Campiano, who's heavily involved in it. He asked us to do a couple of the New York-based interviews. So we said, yeah, sure. I mean, I loved it when I was growing up. I loved the Tim Curry's portrayal of the clown, and I was a huge fan, me and my brother alike, and we decided, hey, we want to roll with this. It's such an iconic thing in the horror community, and we just went with it, you know?
Is featured in the documentary?
Pretty much the entire original cast. That's
so
easy.
Tim Curry, yeah, Tim Curry, Seth Green's in it, so they got everybody that was in the movie, besides a few smaller roles, but they got the kid that played the original Georgie's in it, they got all the kids that played the little kids in the movie, and they got some of the adults as well, and they got the cinematographer and the director
and
everything.
Even interesting people you might not think of, like the person who designed the poster art and deeper down the line like that, so it's a lot of knowledge you're not going to find anywhere else.
When can we expect this documentary to come out?
By the end of this year. I can't give you an exact date, but they're hoping by the end of 2019 it'll be out.
Will it be available on places like Amazon?
Yes. Yes, and I pretty much guarantee there'll be a Blu-ray with a lot of extra features that are worth checking out, because there are hours and hours of interview footage that could not make the actual cut, so there's so much more than the final version.
So it's going to be a very loaded Blu-ray.
Very loaded. Very informative to the fans, and they'll be very happy with it to know the full story of it.
Well, I want to thank you, Jason, and thank you, Stephen, for coming on the podcast. Have a good day, and good luck with your future projects.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having us on.
Have a podcast that you want to promote? Well, if you're interested in swapping commercials, you can promote your show here on Anthony T's Horror Show, and in return, I will promote your commercial on my show as well. For more information, contact me at AnthonyT'sHorrorShow@gmail.com. You can find Anthony T's Horror Show on social media on these platforms. Facebook at facebook.com/AnthonyT's Horror Show. Twitter at www.twitter.com/AnthonyT's Horror. On Instagram at www.instagram.com/AnthonyT's Horror Show. On YouTube at www.youtube.com/AnthonyThurber. And you can
find Anthony T's Horror Show on the web as well at anthonytshorrorshow.blogspot.com. And you can also find Doc Discussions at www.docdiscussions.com. For my film recommendation this episode, in the description of the show, I said I would be recommending a film that just recently came out on DVD. And no, it's not Rob Zombie's 3 from Hell. Even though I enjoy 3 from Hell, this is not the film recommendation this episode. The film recommendation this episode is a film called Haunt. Now, this is a film that I recently reviewed on the official website of Anthony T's Horror Show, which you can find at anthonytshorrorshow.blogspot.com. But I'm going to recommend this film anyway because this is such a very good film. I've now seen this film twice, and I really stand by my review of the film on my website because I had a really good time watching this film. And in fact, I even had a better time the second time because I managed to pick up a thing or two that I didn't pick up in my first viewing, which really makes this film even more better in my opinion. One of the things that I really liked about Haunt a lot was the fact that the film does a very good job setting up everything, whether it's the kills, whether it's the climax, whether it's the beginning of the film where you're getting to know these characters. Everything is set up well that it makes the film very good and fun to watch. The film is directed by Scott Beck and Brian Woods. Now, those two last year co-wrote the box office hit A Quiet Place. I'm really surprised this film has not gotten much attention because this is a very good film. In fact, this is a very good Halloween film, as it really is one of those films that I would definitely put in the endless list of Halloween films to watch every Halloween season. The directors do a very good job with the way they keep everything moving, whether it's the action or the film's dark tone. Everything's done in a way that it's just very good. It really made Haunt a very fun film to watch. The film also has a great performance from Katie Stevens. She does a very good job carrying this film, whether it's the way she handles the character's emotions in the backstory to the action. She really does a great job making sure her character is interesting and entertaining enough to keep your interest throughout the whole film. There's also a very good performance by Damien Melfi, as he always seems to have some very good performances, especially in this film as Red Devil. He's just creepy looking. And once you take the mask off, he's even more creepier. Not as bonkers as his role in The Strangers Pray at Night, but I really love Damien Melfi. He's just one of those actors, I think, that handles these silent roles very well. Even though he gets a couple of lines here, it's just the way he moves that makes his characters very menacing. I would love to see more of him in the future. Just saying. I really highly recommend you check out Haunt. This is definitely one of my favorite horror films of the year, and this will probably most likely be in my top 10 horror films of 2019, as the performances are great and it has great writing and great direction from Scott Beck and Brian Woods. So definitely check out Haunt. Pick up the DVD in stores now. The film will also be hitting Shudder on October 24th, so by the time this episode comes out, it could already be on Shudder. But definitely check this film out. Easily one of the best films I've seen all year. And Haunt is a intense film with a intense ending. And that's why Haunt is my film recommendation for this episode. on the YouTube channel at youtube.com/AnthonyThurber. I recently released the Rock and Shock DIY Filmmakers panel. This features filmmakers such as Kyle Kirchta and Bill Fulkerson, directors of Survival of the Film Freaks, and also Brian Poland from Morbid Vision Films. Definitely check out that panel, as that just went up right after production ended on this episode. Keep an eye out also on the YouTube channel, as I will also be posting the Indie Comics panel, as I wanted to do something different this year. Instead of having the regular star-studded panels, I figured this focus on indie films and indie comics to give these people the exposure that they deserve. Because not a lot of you people have heard about these indie films, these indie filmmakers, these indie comic writers, these indie comic artists. So I wanted to focus on that as my panels on the YouTube channel to get a more better glimpse of the independent film and comic book world. So I hope you enjoy these panels. You can go to the official YouTube channel on YouTube at youtube.com/AnthonyThurber, T-H-U-R-B-E-R. With that, I want to thank you for listening to Anthony T's Horror Show. I will be back next week with more interviews from Rock and Shock. With that, have a good day and support indie horror.